For our topic this morning, we will extend Hanukkah by an extra day, talking about Judas Menorah. That's our topic. In order to get there, I have a question. I suspect the answer to this is no, but let me try anyway. Any of you belong to a synagogue where they say as part of the service something called Yotzros? It's extremely unpopular these days. A century ago, it was very common in Europe. Nope, not familiar. Okay, so here's what Yotzros are. The morning service, after the initial part, there's something called Barco, and then after Barco, you get to Shema. In between the Barco and Shema, there's a blessing that starts with the word Yotzer, and that's what gives this prayer its name. Yotzros are piyutim. Piyutim, religious poetry, basically, which was composed, in this case, somewhere around the 9th to 11th centuries, which some synagogues, and again, historically many synagogues, particularly Ashkenazi ones, would insert for special occasions. So you have your regular prayers that would be said every day and prayers for a Shabbat, and then on special weeks or special days, you would have poems that would be inserted in the prayer. Because they were inserted in a blessing called Yotzer, they became called Yotzrot. And the poems would be appropriate for whatever occasion was being commemorated. So here I have for you, at the top of your sheet, an excerpt from one such poem, which was written in the 11th century, as I noted on the sheet. And that'll be a reminder for phones. The poem is called Odcha Ki Anach Tavi, which is a line taken from Psalms. Take a look, please, at this translation of it. The translation is available online. Dr. Sarah Regur is a professor in New York. She did the translation. Listen to these lines. But during that night, and obviously we need to know what that night is, Judith came to my defense. Her secret project was blessed, and her reasoning excellent. She encouraged her people and was a torch of fire against Greece. Content that the city and its citizens were on the right path, she was very happy and went with her slave, and putting all of her hope in God, she stopped at the entrance of the enemy encampment in order to undo their happiness and make them suffer and feel the punishment for the sins of their leader. This is an excerpt. It's a very long poem. It's a poem that deals with several Hanukkah events, not only the story of Judith, but this hints to a story that hopefully some people are familiar with, and that is indeed the story of Judith. Anyone here familiar with her story? I got one. No, there are a few people saying yes. She killed Holofernes, who was not a king, general of some army somewhere. And that's part of the problem. What I want to do is learn the story of Judith, called in Hebrew Yehudit, how it was used in Jewish law to explain why women light the menorah on Hanukkah, and I'll explain what that's about, and to gain an understanding through that of the relationship between the two miracles of Hanukkah, the military victory, and the miracle of the oil. So we have a lot to cover here, but we'll do all right, I hope. Starting with Judith's story. Now, there are multiple versions of this story. We do not have the original Hebrew, if it ever existed. There are those who suggest that it was actually written originally in Greek, which is kind of ironic because it becomes a story about her execution of a Greek general. But they don't mind that. I always wonder about that. You know, we said that if somebody converts to Judaism, so they fully become Jewish. And therefore, all the blessings and prayers where we say God of our ancestors, they say also, because they've adopted our ancestors as their own. But I have to wonder, if someone who is Greek converts to Judaism, and they light the menorah, and they say the blessing, thanking God for performing miracles for our ancestors at that day, at that time, one wonders about how they feel. And in reciting that, I mean, the Hebrew the Hebrew Shasnan Nisim La'avotenu. So you could read that as perform miracles for our ancestors, or who perform miracles to our ancestors. One way or the other. That's a bit of a digression. The bottom line is, we don't have the original Hebrew, if there was one, of the book of Judith. We're going to work with a version that is that's sort of a standard version that's available free online, which means I can cut and paste it. I gave you a link for it in source number 2. Those who got the email that I sent out in advance with this can click on the link, and you'll be able to get the story. But here's a summary of the story. The summary comes from Professor Deborah Levine Gayra. She's a professor at Hebrew University in the Classics Department. And I think it's a pretty good summary. Take a look at source number 3. The book opens with a successful campaign waged by Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Assyrians, against Arpakshad, king of the Medes. Nebuchadnezzar then sends his chief of staff, Holofernes, on an ambitious and punitive military campaign directed against those who did not join him in his earlier successful war. So he fought a war, he won the war, and now he goes after the people who didn't help him. All nations give way before Holofernes until he approaches the Jews, who decide to resist. The Jews of a place called Betulia must block the Assyrians' path to Jerusalem and its temple. Holofernes, who is unacquainted with the Jews, learns something of their history and religious beliefs from his ally, the Ammonite Achior. Despite Achior's warning that God may well defend his people, Holofernes places a siege on Betulia. When water supplies run low, the people of the town press their leaders to surrender to the Assyrians. And Uzziah, the chief leader, promises to capitulate if there's no relief within 5 days. You get the picture. Holofernes and his forces are laying siege to a Jewish city, which is critical to the defense of Jerusalem. The city is under siege, and they're ready to surrender. It is at this point that the pious, beautiful widow Judith steps on stage. Judith, who leads an ascetic, solitary life, summons Uzziah and his fellow leaders to her home and reprimands them for their lack of faith in God. She then takes matters into her own hands. Judith prays, bathes, removes her widow's weeds. Dressed to kill, Judith leaves Betulia for the enemy Assyrian camp, accompanied only by her faithful maid. The glamorous Judith charms and deceives Holofernes as well as his trusty eunuch Bagoas and promises to deliver the Jews to the Assyrians with God's help. So she pretends that she is on the Assyrian side. She pretends to be betraying her people. Lost the place. In her dealings with Holofernes, Judith is not only beautiful, but sharp-witted. Her exchanges with the enemy commander are ironic and two-edged, and her subtle, duplicitous words are one of the chief charms of the apocryphal book. Apocryphal means that it's text that's not part of the canon, it's not part of Tanakh, it is from outside of that, but it has been transmitted generation through generation as a quasi-holy book. Holofernes invites Judith to a party in order to seduce her. But he drinks a great deal of wine and collapses on his couch. Judith then seizes Holofernes' sword and cuts off the head of the sleeping general. She returns to Betulia with Holofernes' head in a bag. Look what I found shopping. And his canopy as well. I borrowed that from a book. There's a book that has a whole story that's very much like this, but they don't acknowledge it. Anyway, Achior the Ammonite converts to Judaism when he learns of Judith's deed and sees the actual dead man's head. The Jews of Betulia follow Judith's advice, subsequently take the offensive, attacking the Assyrian army and defeating them. Judith, praised by all, sings a victory song and then goes back to her quiet life at home. She lives until the ripe old age of 105 and is mourned by all of Israel when she dies. Happy ending. That's a good summary of the book. The book takes a lot longer to get there, 16 chapters. But that's pretty good. Now, there are all sorts of questions about the historicity of this story. Did this story actually happen? The story is believed to have been put in writing in the 2nd century before the Common Era, which is the time when the events of Hanukkah took place. Hanukkah is traced to approximately the year 160 to 166 before the Common Era. So in that sense, it could have been that time. But let me ask you, looking at the summary that we just read in number 3, how many Greeks do you see there? There are no Greeks. described as being Assyrian. There are all sorts of questions associated with that, because who else is described here as being Assyrian? Well, that's true. But King Nebuchadnezzar, tell me, Nebuchadnezzar was king of whom?
Babylon.
Nebuchadnezzar is a Babylonian king. So what's that about? So that leads some to question the historicity of the story, that and other factors. The truth is, that's not a big deal. Because when you look at the historians of the time, you find that often people were, kings were named based on the nations they had conquered. In other words, you conquered a nation, an empire, you conquered their territory, so you were now the king who lived in Assyria when you conquered the Assyrians. Cyrus gets named for people the Persians conquer all the time. That in and of itself is not a challenge to the legitimacy of the record here. There are many other questions, though, about the historical accuracy of the book. But what's particularly interesting to me is that this book, as I said, is post-Tanakh, it's post-Scripture, meaning Scripture is closed centuries before the events of this story take place. It does not make it into Tanakh. The story does not show up, really, in Jewish sources and Jewish discussion. Christians love it. The Christians love this story. This is a big one for them. Not really in Jewish literature. It's only about 1,000 years later, 9th, 10th century, that it starts to show up in our literature. Yes? Why would they like this story so much? What do you think?
Woman.
Yeah, that's true. What? Sorry. It's a woman.
No,
I think a woman. So it's funny because is that the noise from this microphone or is that something else?
It's the sound system microphone.
No. Okay. Hopefully the sound doesn't bother people. So it's true that Christianity has an up and down relationship in terms of women. That's true. At the same time, Christianity is founded on mother worship. When you go back to the origins of the religion, the role that Mary plays is very significant for them. I'm not enough of a Christian scholar to trace who liked this, when they liked it, and so on. But I do know that the story becomes very popular, much like the story of Esther becomes very popular with that.
And also the book of Daniel.
Well, I love the book of Daniel because it speaks of end times and prophecies of what will be, and they use it to support their tradition. So that's for sure true. So, about the 9th century or so, 9th, 10th century, you start to see other versions of this story show up in Jewish tradition, like that poem that I mentioned at the outset that records it. But if you go back to the poem now, in source number one, you see she was a torch of fire against Greece. They turn it into a story about the Greeks, even though that wasn't in the original version. This professor Gaira did a lot of work on this, and she noted a few differences between the first version that we have and later versions. The later versions spend less time talking about Judith's beauty and her piety. Interestingly, in later versions of it, when she comes back with the head, the guards of the city of Betulia don't believe her that it's the head of Holofernes. I guess they think it's a random head she found somewhere. The connection to Greece and to Hanukkah becomes much more explicit, and the connections between Judith and stories that are found in our scripture, in Tanakh, becomes a lot stronger. There are already links that are found in the original story. For starters, she charms her way to Holofernes, reminding us of Esther, right? Also, take a look at what I brought you here, number 4 on your sheet, please. This is from chapter 12 of the book of Judith. When she is already with the king, she's already gotten out of things, the general, Holofernes. He commanded them to bring her in where his silver dishes were kept, and ordered them to set a table for her with some of his own food, and to serve her with his own wine. But Judah said, I cannot eat it, lest it be an offense, meaning a sin. But I will be provided from the things I have brought with me. Holofernes said to her, if your supply runs out, where can we get more like it for you? For none of your people is here with us. Judith replied, "As your soul lives, my lord, your servant will not use up the things I have with me before the Lord carries out by my hand what he has determined me to do." Right? I'm not planning on staying long. That's part of what Professor Gayla meant when she said, like, the charm of the book is in that kind of language that she uses. But what's particularly interesting, and we mentioned Daniel already, is what I brought you here in source number 5. From the first chapter of the book of Daniel, and I'm using the JPS translation here, it's not my own. "The king allotted daily rations to them from the king's food and from the wine he drank." This is talking about Daniel and his three friends, who are captured by the Babylonians when they destroy the first temple in their invasions. They capture them and they bring them to his court. I'm going to... Should I try without the microphone? Is that... Okay, as long as it's not distracting anybody else. Okay, so the king, in which case this actually is, should I try that one? Yeah, no, it's not this, it must be something else. Okay, you're right. Okay, so in this story, King Nebuchadnezzar, who has taken these Jews captive, allots rations to them. And they're supposed to get from his food, and they're supposed to get from his wine. They're supposed to be educated for 3 years, at the end of which they are to enter the king's service. And Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the king's food or the wine he drank. So he sought permission from the chief officer not to defile himself. He doesn't want to have the king's food and wine. So Daniel's story, which precedes Judith by a few centuries, is clearly linked to what's going on with Judith. It's not the only connection. Halevernes is described as falling down drunk at this party that he has with Judith. Well, we know that story, but take a look at number 6, first of all. Halevernes was greatly pleased with her and drank a great quantity of wine, much more than he had ever drunk in any one day since he was born. Take a look at source number 7, about Babylonian King Belshazzar. "King Belshazzar made a great meal for his 1,000 leaders, and he drank wine opposite 1,000. Because of the wine, Belshazzar said to bring the gold and silver vessels, which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the sanctuary in Jerusalem, and they would drink with them." Belshazzar is also into his drinking, and of course there's another king, a Persian king, who's known for his drinking, and that is Ahasuerus. Right, Ahasuerus is known for his parties and his drinking at those parties. So another link to Tanakh for this story. Another, her assassination of Halevernes, this general, is linked to other assassinations, in particular the story of Yael. Take a look at source number 8. This is the one that everybody has to associate with Judith. The story of Yael is from the early in the book of Shoftim, the book of Judges. The Jews are at this point rebelling against the Canaanites who have been controlling them. And Yael, well, first Deborah leads the Jews in battle against the forces of Canaan, and then the Canaanite general Sisera is on the run. So take a look at source number 8. "Sisera, meanwhile, had fled on foot to the tent of Yael, wife of Heber the Keni, for there was friendship between King Yabin of Hazor," that's the Canaanite king, "and the family of Heber the Keni. Yael came out to greet Sisera and said to him, 'Come in, my lord, come in here, do not be afraid.' So he entered her tent, and she covered him with a blanket. He said to her, 'Please let me have some water, I am thirsty.' She opened a skin of milk and gave him some to drink, and she covered him again. He said to her, 'Stand at the entrance of the tent. If anybody comes and asks you if there's anybody here, say no.' Then Yael, wife of Heber, took a tent pin and grasped the mallet. When he was fast asleep from exhaustion, she approached him stealthily and drove the pin through his temple till it went down to the ground. Thus he died." So here you have, again, precedent in Tanakh for the story of the woman who assassinates the enemy general. One more association. Chapter 16, take a look at source number 9 from the book of Judith.
Judah said, "Begin a song to my God with tambourines. Sing to my Lord with cymbals. Raise to him a new psalm. Exalt him. Call upon his name. For God is the Lord who crushes wars. For he has delivered me out of the hands of my pursuers, brought me to his camp in the midst of the people." You can find within this poem all sorts of links to biblical poems from various times, whether the song that you sang at the sea or others. The Assyrian, she sings, came down from the mountains of the north. He came with myriads of his warriors. Their multitude blocked up the valleys. Their cavalry covered the hills. He boasted that he would burn up my territory, kill my young men with a sword, dash my infants to the ground, seize my children as prey, take my virgins as booty. But the Lord Almighty has spoiled them by the hand of a woman. All sorts of links between this song and other songs that are found within Tanakh. And in particular, the last line, "The Lord Almighty has spoiled them by the hand of a woman." Because take a look at source number 10, a little bit more background on that story involving the war against Canaan that the Jews fought. The Jews were led at the time by a prophetess named Deborah. Deborah brought God's message to a general named Barak, saying, "You should lead the Jews in battle against Canaan." And Barak said, "I'm not going unless you go." Well, look at her response in source number 10. This is what she says. She's quoting God. "And I will draw Sisera, Yabin's army commander, with his chariots and his troops toward you, up to the Wadi Kishon, and I will deliver him unto your hands." But Barak said to her, "If you will go with me, I will go. If not, I will not go." "Very well, I will go with you," she answered. "However, there will be no glory for you in the course you are taking, for then the Lord will deliver Sisera into the hands of a woman." So Deborah went with Barak to Kedesh. The idea of the defeat of the enemy general at the hands of a woman, and the idea that this is somehow considered ignominious for him, he didn't die in battle with a soldier, instead he's killed by a woman, is a theme in both. So what you're seeing here, to sum up what I've been trying to show, is there are many links between the story and events in Tanakh, meaning in the original book of Judith, and events in Tanakh, like the way she charms her way to Holofernes, which is associated with Esther, the refusal to eat the food that she's given from Holofernes' table, like Daniel. Holofernes being a drunkard is like King Belshazzar and King Ahasuerus. Assassination of a foreign leader through subterfuge by a woman is done by Judith and by Yael. The victory song has parallels in other songs in Tanakh. But when you get to the later versions of the story, you find more associations, and one in particular. There is a tradition of eating what foods on Hanukkah? Fried in oil, right? Latkes, sukkahs, right? People have oil-based foods on Hanukkah. There's another tradition, though, besides the oil foods. Cheese. That's right. Having dairy on Hanukkah. People think of it for Shavuot. But there is a centuries-old tradition of having dairy on Hanukkah. Why? The oil, I understand. You have a miracle of oil. Right? The oil lasts 8 days, just like the heartburn from the latkes. What I understand is, where does dairy figure into the story? And the answer is, it doesn't. Until you get to the later versions of the Judith story. The original one said that she got him drunk. But however, the later versions say that she actually fed him milk. That's the idea. Take a look at source number 11. Rabbi Yehiel Michal Epstein sums it up in a code of Jewish law. He's writing in the early, very beginning of the 20th century, but it's really much older than this source. This was just a convenient one. He says, "And later on a miracle happened via Judith, who fed the enemy milk. Based on this, there are those who are careful to eat cheese on Hanukkah. Even though this did not happen at the time of the miracle of Hanukkah," that clause I'm going to come back to. But the point is the association with dairy. In fact, the association with dairy appears in the later versions of the Judith story, and appears to be borrowed from the story of Yael, because we did read that Yael gave milk to Sisera. So the later ones draw on...
Is that why we have sour cream and lattes?
Yes, that's why people would have sour cream and lattes, precisely. Because everybody knows they should be having applesauce, but that's... Okay, I am not getting into that debate. So, here you have the story of Judith. That's your story in a nutshell. As I said, there are questions regarding the historical record and this story. And also, as we just noted in source number 11, the story doesn't seem to be about Hanukkah. I mean, if it's Assyrian, it's entirely the wrong time in our history. Certainly, if it's Babylonian, it's centuries earlier than there are any Greeks on the scene. This has nothing to do with Greece. Halicarnassus sounds like a nice Greek name, I guess. What do I know about Greek names? But the story doesn't seem to be Greek originally. This doesn't seem to be about a Greek general being killed. It doesn't seem to relate to the events of Hanukkah at all. So that leads to this question, right? Which is, so what do we make of this? Why does this story become associated with Hanukkah in the first place? What does this have to do with Hanukkah? And further, the menorah. You see, this takes us to the issue of women lighting the menorah. So we have a general principle in Jewish law. The general principle is that mitzvot which have to be performed at a particular time and involve an action, generally speaking, women are exempt from those. They can do them if they want, but they're exempt. There aren't all that many mitzvot that actually fit into this category. Once you get done with all the exceptions and exclusions, it's between 5 and 10 mitzvot that are like this. Most mitzvot tend to be incumbent for men and women, but there is this exemption. Why there's such an exemption is a good topic for another time, but that's the rule on the books. However, says the Talmud, various celebrations of ours that involve being saved from danger apply to men and women alike, even though they involve celebrations which have to be performed at a particular time. One example of that is Hanukkah candles. Take a look at source number 12, please, from the Talmud. The Talmud states, a woman definitely lights. For Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said, women are obligated in the lamp of Hanukkah, for they were also in that miracle. So women, of course, are supposed to light menorah as well. Now, if there's only one menorah in a house, and then you have to decide who's going to light, so I leave it to the man and woman to decide how they're going to do this. But that's the statement, is that it is in fact for men and women. A similar statement is made regarding having 4 cups of wine at the Seder. Also, a time-bound practice, but women were involved in the miracle of the Exodus, and therefore they are obligated to. And it is brought as well regarding hearing the Megillah read on Purim. Again, a practice that has to be performed at a particular time, but incumbent upon women as well, because they're involved in the miracle. Now, the truth of the matter is, there are two different ways to read that line that says they were involved in the miracle too. The Hebrew is Af Ein Hayu Bo Tohanes. There are two different ways that the commentators read it. One way that they look at it is that the women were in the same danger as everybody else, the rescue helped them too. So if you take a look at source number 13 as an example regarding Purim, even upon the women, Haman decreed to destroy, kill, eliminate from young to old children and women. So therefore it clearly applies to women as well. They were in danger too. And similarly with Hanukkah, the women were in danger also. If you take a look at source number 14, because the Greeks decreed that all women who were to be married for the first time would be taken by the general first. And then he adds another note, though. And because the miracle happened via a woman. The miracle of Hanukkah, he says, happened via a woman. What is Rashi referring to? The story of Judith. He's talking about Hanukkah.
How do we know that? But that doesn't seem to
How do we know what?
That he's referring to.
Because, number one, we don't have any other reason to think that the miracles of Hanukkah were happening from a woman because they were the Maccabees. The Maccabees were male. Number two, though, Rashi in his commentary to the book of Yechezkel has an issue with the translation of a particular word. I didn't go into it on the sheet. But there's a particular word, and Rashi says, I think the word should be translated this way, and he brings support from the same Yotzro poem that we quoted in source number one. So Rashi is familiar with the story. And Rashi has a grandson, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, who in source number 15, commenting on the line that said that women were involved in the miracle, Rashbam explained that via them, via women, the Jews were redeemed. And he says, he's talking about Passover, and the idea that women were critical to the events of the Exodus as well. It is their merit, the Talmud says, that gets the Jews out of Egypt in the first place. So too the Megillah, because of Esther's role for Purim, and Hanukkah via Judith. So they wrote, women liked the menorah, because they were involved in the miracle, meaning not only the women were the ones who were in danger along with everybody else, but they actually were part of the miracle, because Judith helps trigger the miracle of Hanukkah. You follow? Yes.
I follow, but you skipped over 14, and I wanted
it
to explain.
Oh, no, I read it. Okay, the idea that Rashi is presenting is one found in the Talmud in later times as well. Apparently this was a practice of oppressors. There's a phrase for it in French, but my French is awful. So I'm going to write it out, and then you can pronounce it. I believe it is pronounced droit du Seigneur. Is that? Something like that. I realize I'm writing too small for some people to read. Droit du
Seigneur.
Yes, thank you. I'm glad you pronounced it and not me. But essentially, it was the rite of the first night. And it went to the local potentate. So the general would do it. As a matter of fact, it's hinted at in that story of Judith, because she's from the city of Betulia. A Betula in Hebrew is a virgin. That was what they was under threat from the Greeks, according to this. So, what you're seeing here is the following. The chain is supposed to be this. Women were in danger. Women engineered the miracle. Therefore, danger plus miracle, therefore women light the menorah. No, and that's what they're saying. That's not strange. That, you haven't gotten to the Latin part yet. That makes a lot of sense. They were under threat. They're the ones who caused the miracle, so therefore they participate in the ritual to celebrate it. That part I'm good with. Here's the problem. There are two miracles of Hanukkah. Right? We said it at the outset. You have the miracle of the military victory, the war, and then you have the miracle of the oil. We commemorate these two miracles in different ways. I'm going to use another sheet here. We only get one procession, Marjorie, or...
I'd like to see other pen, because definitely that one.
Can't see the green? Okay. I will try the other one, but it really might just be my handwriting. Okay. We're going to try it this way. You have the miracle of the military victory. And then you have the miracle of the oil. And the two seem to be separated in our tradition. Take a look, please, at source number 16. The Talmud tells the story of Hanukkah. The Talmud is, in context, discussing which fuels and wicks are appropriate to use for Shabbat candles, and then which ones are appropriate to use for a menorah, because there is a difference. Because Shabbat candles are supposed to sit by your table, and they're supposed to illuminate the household, and therefore there are rules like, don't use fuels or wicks, that will smell bad. Also, on Shabbat, you're not supposed to adjust the lamp or fix it in any way, so don't use fuels that won't burn well. Right? Make sure you set it up to burn well from the start. That's when it comes to Shabbat candles. On the other hand, the menorah, the Hanukkah, we're not supposed to use that for our own purposes, and therefore there's less of a concern about, on the other end, maybe a preference for olive oil, because that's what the original miracle happens with. So there are different rules for Shabbat candles and for Hanukkah candles. So the Talmud, after discussing some of those rules, comes back and says, what is this Hanukkah thing we're commemorating anyway? Why are we lighting the menorah? And it gives this answer, source number 16. What is Hanukkah? Our sages taught, on the 25th of Kislev, There are 8 days of Hanukkah, starts on the 25th of Kislev, when we neither eulogize nor fast. For when the Greeks entered the sanctuary, they contaminated all of the oil in the sanctuary. And when the monarchy of the house of the Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, mustered strength and defeated them, they searched and could find only one jug of oil marked with the seal of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. There was only enough to kindle for one day, but a miracle occurred and they kindled from it for 8 days. The next year, they established them and made them festivals with hallel and thanks. So, the oil miracle leads to lighting the menorah. Clear? Technically speaking, it's not a menorah, it is a chanukiah, right? You know that?
Yes.
Okay. We're going to call it a menorah anyway, because it's convenient. But yes, it's actually a chanukiah. That's one commemoration. Now take a look at source number 17. This is from the Al HaNisim prayer, which is traditionally recited on Hanukkah as part of the Amidah, as well as in the blessing after meals. In the days of Matityahu, son of Yochanan, the Hasmonean high priest and his sons, when the evil Greek empire arose upon your nation Israel to make them forget your Torah and to divert them from the laws of your will, we're addressing God. You and your great mercy arose for them in their time of trouble. You fought their fight. You performed their judgment. You avenged them. You gave the mighty to the weak, and the many to the few, and the impure to the pure, the wicked to the righteous, and the wicked to those involved in your Torah. And you made a great and holy name for yourself in your world. And you performed a great rescue for your nation Israel, and a redemption as we see today. That is the Al HaNisim prayer. What miracle does it talk about? Where do you see the oil mentioned at all? There is no mention of oil whatsoever. These are really two separate trends. You have the oil trend that the Talmud mentioned, and then in Al HaNisim, it talks about the military victory. So we have a special thanks for God that we express in this prayer that is said, again, in the Amidah, as well as in the blessing after meals, to commemorate the military victory. You have two separate miracles, two separate commemorations, and perhaps the best example of it is in Maimonides. Take a look at source number 18, where Maimonides, the Rambam, gives us, in his Book of Law, a clear division. In the Second Temple, when the Greeks reigned, they issued decrees upon Israel, eliminated their religion, did not allow them to involve themselves in Torah and mitzvot, and they extended their hand against their property and their daughters, and they entered the sanctuary, broke through its structure, and contaminated that which was pure, until the God of our ancestors had mercy upon them and rescued them from their hand and saved them. And the Hasmoneans, the high priest, triumphed and killed them and rescued Israel from their hand and set up a king from among the priests, and monarchy returned to Israel for more than 200 years until the second destruction. The history of this is interesting, but not for right now. The point is, what is he described in this first paragraph? Which victory? Which miracle? The war. And then in his second paragraph, he says, and when Israel defeated their enemies and destroyed them, it was the 25th of Kislev, and they entered the sanctuary, did not find pure oil in the temple, only one jug. It contained enough to light for only one day, and they lit the ritual lamps with it for 8 days until they crushed olives and produced pure oil. Two separate presentations. By the way, I should take note, there are some who argue that because source number 16 in the Talmud only talks about the oil and didn't talk about the military victory, that somehow that demonstrates that the sages were uncomfortable with the military victory, didn't like the Hasmoneans. There were issues with the Hasmoneans, that's true, because the priests weren't supposed to take the throne for themselves. However, if the rabbis were really trying to eliminate the military celebration, they would have done something about this Al HaNisim prayer, which is recited three times a day in the Amidah, and three times a day after every meal. If they really wanted to get rid of it, they did a terrible job. So that's unlikely. I've seen the point made, and that's why I take things to combat it. But the point here is this. Two separate celebrations. Oil the menorah, war with Al HaNisim. And yet, Judith is involved with which miracle? The war. That's where she belongs. So why is it that women commemorate what Judith did by lighting the menorah. Well, no, they're not going to go around cutting off heads of generals to celebrate, but maybe we can find General Wells. I don't know. Maybe there should be some else. Why are they commemorating what Judith did via the menorah? It seems like we've crossed one miracle with another one. So the truth of the matter is that if I had to answer this on the most basic level, if I had to say, okay, Rabbi, what do you do with this problem? The answer I would give is to say, well, menorah was the most visible symbol of the victory, and therefore they did it, even though you're right, it wasn't associated with the miracle. I could give that as a dry answer, and then we could spend the next 15 minutes talking about where people came from. That's in February. But I think there actually is something else you could suggest to explain what's going on here. And that is by looking at Maimonides' next paragraph in source number 19. Maimonides continues his description of the celebrations of Hanukkah. He says, because of this, meaning because of what he recounted in source number 18, because of these miracles, the sages of that generation enacted that these 8 days from the night of the 25th of Kislev should be days of joy and hallel, and they light lamps in the evening at the entrances of houses on each night of the 8 nights to demonstrate and reveal the miracle. And these days are called Chanukah, when they neither eulogize nor fast on them, like the days of Purim, and lighting lamps on them is a rabbinic mitzvah, like reading the Megillah. What Maimonides does is very interesting. Don't flip the page. Don't flip the page. We're not quite ready. Read what he said carefully. Maimonides is careful with his words. And sometimes you can catch a lesson when he uses an extra word. Because of this, the sages of that generation enacted that these 8 days, days of joy and hallel, light lamps, to do what? To demonstrate and reveal the miracle. But there's an extra word. What does that mean? Demonstrate and reveal. What is he trying to accomplish with that? So Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik presented the following thought, which appears in a book called Moadei Harav, which has his ideas in general about the festivals. Take a look at source number 20. The Rav, Rabbi Soloveitchik, explained that there is a difference between to demonstrate and to reveal. The Hebrew, leharot and legalot. To demonstrate means to show. To reveal means to proclaim that which is unknown. He gives an illustration. He says, imagine that there's a certain place that's important to you because of something that happens there. You show somebody, you point to it, and you say, that place over there is special to me. That's Laharot. You show it. But you didn't explain why it's special. You tell the story about the event that was there. That's Legalot. That's to reveal. And so he says, thus there are two aspects to the Persume Nisa of the Hanukkah candle. Persume Nisa means publicizing the miracle. To show and demonstrate, and also to reveal. Meaning, one, to show and demonstrate in order to cause others to focus their attention upon the miracle. This is achieved by lighting candles in a place that is open to the public eye. You're lighting the menorah, you're getting people's attention, but he doesn't explain anything by lighting the menorah. If someone never knew the story of Hanukkah, they wouldn't know it because they saw candles in your window. To reveal, one must explain to the people the meaning of Hanukkah, what the holiday represents, why we fought the Hellenists. It is our duty to analyze the meaning of the miracle, that is, to reveal it. Publicizing the miracle of Hanukkah attests that our connection and relationship to the Hanukkah candle is similar to our connection and relationship to the Shekhinah, to God. The divine presence turns to the Jewish people by way of the Hanukkah candle, and the Hanukkah candle attests that the Shekhinah rests among us. In other words, the menorah, really, the message of the menorah is, God is still with us. The miracles that were found in Tanakh, splitting the sea, hail from the sky, that these miracles can persist, that God is still there. And to me, that explains the association of Judith with the menorah. Take a look, please, at source number 21 from that original book of Judith. And see what I underlined in particular. This chapter from the book, chapter 13, is the one in which she kills Holofernes. Look at what she does. Now, Judith had told her maid to stand outside the bedchamber and to wait for her to come out, as she did on the other days. For she said she would be going out for her prayers. She had said the same thing to Bagoas. So everyone went out. No one, either small or great, was left in the bedchamber. Then Judith, standing beside his bed, Holofernes' bed, said in her heart, O Lord, God of all might, look in this hour on the work of my hands for the exaltation of Jerusalem. Now indeed is the time to help your heritage and to carry out my design to destroy the enemies who have risen up against us. She prays to God for help. She went up to the bedpost near Holofernes' head, took down his sword that hung there, came close to his bed, took hold of the hair of his head, and said, Give me strength today, O Lord, God of Israel. Struck his neck twice with all her might, cut off his head, rolled his body off the bed, pulled down the canopy from the posts. Soon afterwards, she went out and gave Holofernes' head to her maid, who placed it in her food bag, because, well, you know, is it convenient to walk through the streets? Then the two of them went out together, as they were accustomed to do for prayer. They passed through the camp, circled around the valley, went up the mountain, you know, he didn't think it was funny, went up the mountain to Betulia, and came to its gates. From a distance, Judith called out to the sentries of the gates, Open, open the gate. God, our God, is with us, still showing his power in Israel, his strength against our enemies, as he has done today. And the people hear her voice. They hurry to the gate. They ran together, small and great. It seemed unbelievable she had even made it back. They opened the gate and welcomed them, lit a fire to give light, gathered around them, and she says in a loud voice, Praise God, oh, praise him. Praise God who has not withdrawn his mercy from the house of Israel, but has destroyed our enemies by my hand this very night. Takes out the head, shows it to them. And again, the Lord has struck him down by the hand of a woman, as the Lord lives who has protected me in the way I went. She tells them that that God helped her do it, and she explains what she did. And all the people were greatly astonished. They bowed down and worshipped God and said with one accord, Blessed are you, our God, who have this day humiliated the enemies of your people. That's the message, which is the same message that Rabbi Soloveitchik noted, the message of the menorah. Her story isn't, hang on, her story is not from the time of Hanukkah, but it carries the theme of Hanukkah that God powered a military victory for us. And it needs a day to commemorate it. There has to be a time when Jews are going to do something to mark this. And so that becomes Hanukkah. And it's okay that we do it with the menorah, because the menorah celebrates that theme that is at the core of both miracles, that God is in fact with us. In fact, if you take a look at the last source that I brought you on the sheet, Rabbi Yosef Rosen, also known as the Rugged Shavar Gaon, comments on Maimonides to say there are two miracles commemorated here with the menorah. It's not just one. One is the lamps, and the other is their rescue from the idolaters. Both of them are actually being commemorated with the menorah. There are other comments that are similar. I just brought you that as as an example of it. But what it shows us is that in fact the menorah and the water, I'm sorry, the oil and the water are being commemorated with the menorah, and they commemorate a theme which is fundamentally the same as what Judith is trying to get across, as we just saw here, five times or six times, the invocation of God. Yes?
If a man, due to unforeseen circumstances, were to light the menorah, would he unwittingly be creating a scene and doing something extremely disrespectful?
Oh, the mitzvah's for everybody, men and women. The mitzvah's for men and women. It's both. The mitzvah is for men and women. It's not, I didn't mean to give the impression that it was exclusively for women. It's, no, it works for both. Yes?
It's a symbol
were deciding in the region, the weeks. It was a very simplistic way, but they understood that very well as opposed to trying to get them.
Yeah, and Marlene points out that you find in the society in which we live that people don't really understand Hanukkah. They think Hanukkah is somehow parallel. You know, they've got theirs and we've got ours, and they're, you know, they've got lights and we've got lights. So she presented a simplified version of the events that it's about freedom from assimilation into the greater Greek society. I think cutting off Holofernes' head is a story everybody can understand. But what we get here is this. Number one, we learn a bit about the story, right? The story itself, the story of Judas. So we come away with knowledge of a story which is not in Tanakh, but very clearly has been part of Jewish tradition, made it into Jewish prayers, was considered the basis for the custom of having dairy on Hanukkah, was considered the basis for women lighting the menorah. So it's a very central story for us. We come away with two questions. Number one, if it didn't happen with the Greeks and Hanukkah time, why are we doing it here? And number two, why are we linking it with the menorah if it's really about a military victory? And so, to me, what we're seeing here is that it echoes the themes of Hanukkah. It's this aid attributed to God, helping us to overpower an enemy, and that's something that the menorah commemorates as well. The menorah is about that aid from God, as Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed out. Lighting the menorah is your first step, but then you actually have to explain it to people. Marlene gives us a simplified way to explain it to people. There can be longer conversations depending on how much time they have, but I think that that's a critical element. I realize I'm coming here to say this the day after Hanukkah, but this is good because it means you have a year to plan, and because it's a leap year on the Hebrew calendar, so you have a few extra weeks to do your planning for next year about how you're going to celebrate, what kind of Judith party you're going to have, what the decorations look like. Will there be wine or will there be cheese? Depends on how much tradition you have, right? Okay, Marjorie.
I have a question. They make a point of Judith killing Holofernes.
Yes.
Which in many, many paintings, I'm not sure Caravaggio has a painting of her, but we have to hear it. It's exemplified in that this woman does this horrific killing. Why didn't she just poison him? Why couldn't she just give him a dagger to the heart? Why does it have to be?
She had to drink the water.
So the question Marjorie asks is, why do you have to do it in such a horrific way? Yes.
Because she wanted to show the people they had.
Yeah.
Of the enemy.
Right.
And he was dead.
Right. I think you need to be able to bring back evidence. You need something to show people. And I think there is the echo of the story of Yael. Right? In which she takes what she has at her disposal. She takes a tent peg. You know, and just plunged it through his head. Like, that's what's available. It wasn't here, it was the temple. It was over here. Yes? Well, David and Goliath is over here, right? That's the slingshot. But I think, realistically, what does she have at her disposal? You know, she's getting into the enemy camp. Like, you know, this is, his sword is right there. You know, that's what you do. And yes, then she's able to bring it back. But if you want to ask her, I wouldn't want to be the one to ask you this question. At least keep sharp objects away first. But thank you very much.